This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm.
You're listening to This Day in History, a podcast dedicated to examining history from a standpoint of determining which event on any given day had the greatest impact on our lives. Now your host, Tony Hubert and Armand Kachigian.
Welcome into the program. It's This Day in History on lineupmedia.fm. If you have not figured it out by now, this is not your normal history podcast. We are here to have some fun, some debate, and to get you to think. My name is Tony Hubert, my co-host Armand Kachigian, and today, Armand, we look at November the 29th.
Right. But I'm not sure we want to engender any thinking. We'll do the thinking. You just listen.
Really?
Yes.
I like my audience
Don't think. Just whatever I tell you is true.
Remember okay. That. Let's get started before we get to our big topics. On this date in the year 800, Charlemagne arrives in Rome, and he's looking for one Pope Leo III to investigate his alleged crimes. Now, if Charlemagne comes looking for you, even if you're the Pope, that's not a good thing.
That's time to cower in your cassock, yeah?
Yeah. 1781, the crew of the British slave ship Zong murders 133 Africans that are on board by dumping them into the sea so that they could claim insurance on it. Now, a lot of people...
How little things change.
How a lot of people might actually be familiar with this event, but not know it through artwork.
Well, there's a very famous painting by J.M.W. Turner called The Slave Ship, and I believe that was depicting Zong. Interesting how they arrived at it. Apparently, I kind of read up on what the insurance was on these ships. And if they died by, quote, natural causes, i.e. starved to death or whatever happened, infection, you know, obviously that's a pretty tough trek over the ocean.
Relentless trek.
They didn't get reimbursed. So if they drowned, apparently, they did get reimbursed. That's why they threw them overboard. Even if they died on land, they didn't get reimbursed somehow. But, it was interesting.
Good grief.
But the only good thing, I guess, it did turn a lot of public opinion, which was already against slavery in the British Empire. And it did lead to the Slave Trade Act of 1807, which didn't totally eradicate slavery. But
it did slow it down. And it slowed the triangle
no
down.
No more trade from Africa.
Yeah, it slowed the triangle down greatly.
But it was tough to enforce, unfortunately.
Since the dawn of insurance, there's been insurance fraud.
True.
That's sadly what we learn out of this event, not to count the loss of 133 lives in an already, horrible situation.
Little hail damaged scams, but this is
1830, the November uprising, an armed rebellion against Russia's rule in Poland begins. The Poles and the Russians. Yeah, no.
Time of upheaval, 1830 to 1848.
They've been at it ever since.
We'll get to those.
1847, the Whitman Massacre out in the West, the Umatilla Indians and the Cayuse
Indians. I've never heard of this, I have to admit.
It happened on this
date. Cayuse War? Yeah. I've never heard of it.
1864, the American Indians War, the Sand Creek Massacre
that
in Colorado specifically.
Yeah, this guy... Chivington, John Chivington, he was a colonel. And now I've read conflicting reports on this. Some people say he just was out to kill as many Indians as he could. The others say that there were, it was more of a retribution for the Indians or Native Americans attacking settlers. Either way, this guy was pretty rough. Apparently he killed women and children mostly. Of the 150, like 100 were women and children. And I don't know, it's how you defend that. But
this is years before Little Bighorn.
Yeah, this is 1864, and I guess it didn't receive a lot of attention because it was during the Civil War and people had other things on their mind. Another black eye in our history.
1877, Thomas Edison, he demonstrates his phonograph for the first time.
I don't think it'll work.
You don't think it'll catch on?
It's kind of hokey to me. I don't think so.
In 1899, FC Barcelona, the Association Football Club, is founded. Do you know what Association Football is?
Yes, I do, but I wonder why you included this. I'm beginning to think.
Do you know where the term soccer comes from?
Effete Europeans.
There's nothing effete about this sport.
No, I don't know about that.
No, I do.
All right, go ahead.
The term soccer. Any idea where it comes?
I think I've heard it before, but refresh my memory.
Take the English word association.
Yes.
It would often be abbreviated A-S-S-O-C.
Ah, that makes sense.
And the English have a way, as you know, of putting at the end of a lot of words. So a soccer. And,
but that's odd that we adopted it and they didn't. They still call it football, of course.
But they do call it football, but you will hear Englishmen say soccer. You will.
Okay.
It's not a forbidden word.
Okay.
you will hear it.
All right.
In 1902, speaking of football, we changed to American football.
Yeah, real football.
Long before the NFL is founded, the Pittsburgh Stars defeated the Philadelphia Athletics 11-0 at the Pittsburgh Coliseum to win the first championship that is associated with a league known as the American National Professional Football League.
You know, it's interesting and ironic, I guess, that their viewership is down so much this year. So I don't know what's going on, but it's not good.
No. Well,
down a lot.
As the Cowboys keep getting better and better, that'll help.
Yeah,
trust me.
We have a show about that if you want to.
Cowboyspodcast.com.
You want to immolate yourself.
With John Kabingian and Steve Flowers.
Podcast version of Seppuku.
Now. All right.
Not a
1945, the Federal People's Republic of Yugoslavia is declared.
Yeah, Tito. I think Tito's in charge.
And Tito held that together for over 40-plus years.
Yeah.
I had relatives who have traveled back to Yugoslavia, Serbian heritage.
Okay.
And who met distant cousins. Well, not so distant, actually. Second cousins and so forth. And then once the war happened, completely lost contact with them. So 20 years on, absolutely fear the worst. But my great uncle Paul would go back to the homeland. He wasn't born there, but his father.
Where is this?
His father was born in Pristina, Kosovo.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, Kosovo, okay. Yeah.
In 1950, in the Korean War, the North Koreans and the Chinese forced the United Nations to retreat from North Korea.
Oh, yeah, sure retreated.
1963, U.S. President Lyndon Johnson, he forms the Warren Commission, which we talked about
on a previous show
that started the investigation of the assassination of President Kennedy. And on this date in 1967, in the Vietnam War, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, announces his resignation. I had mentioned McNamara before for the excellent film, The Shadow of the Fog of War.
Right.
The Fog of War, which you can find at Amazon.com.
Yeah.
And I highly recommend it. But this was McNamara's almost exit from the public profile, but not quite.
No. He was actually elected president of the World Bank same year. And I'm not a big fan of the World Bank either. I'd rather watch football, soccer. Read Murray Rothbard, A History of Money and Banking in the United States. I think probably have that on Amazon, I'm sure.
Murray Rothbard.
Yeah, one of my favorite authors. Anything by Murray Rothbard, you can't go wrong. Look him up.
So check that out. Also
Brilliant,
try
man.
At audible.com, which is one of our sponsors at audible.com. You can get a 30-day free trial by just simply going to audibletrial.com/thisdayinhistorypodcast. And a free audiobook download is waiting for you.
Well, you'd be very unwise not to do that.
No, absolutely. You got to take advantage
of it.
If you
want to think a little bit, do that.
Two more things to get to. 1897, the first motorcycle race
is held. Surrey, England. Yeah,
Surrey, England. Now, the first automobile race had been held 2 years previously.
Yes, you impressed.
In Chicago.
The significance of that upon
me the other day.
But what do you think about this? Does this have the same significance, the same?
Not as quite, because while motorcycles are
certainly important,
you know, they're basically single unit movers, where a car.
Plus, we're an America-centric show, and that was in Chicago, and this is in Surrey, England. So we're going to downplay the significance of this.
Yeah.
Anything that happens in the United States, of course, takes precedence.
What do I care about what happens in Surrey?
Greatest country
in
the world.
In 1890, a game was played between Army and Navy that really doesn't resemble the football we know today, but hence, it was the first Army-Navy football game.
That's what I've read. Yep, 24-0 Navy, the midshipmen, handed it to them.
So there you have it. Those are the topics.
Those are the less than
the less than topics
that we
are not going to dwell on. We have five very good ones today that we're going to dwell on at some length. And I want to begin by telling you, again, audible.com, amazon.com, bring you this show. And you can find your Christmas list, whatever you need. Just simply go to thisdayinhistorypodcast.com.
Look, I shall do that.
Look for the Amazon banner, click the Amazon banner, and go shopping. And there is plenty there for you to choose from. If you have not signed up for Amazon Prime, we encourage you to do so.
Good idea.
Now.
That's a good idea. I
especially
do that.
Now.
I think they have a. I think they might have a special too. Is it Friday or something? Look that up. It's coming up.
Well, Cyber Monday.
Special deal.
Cyber.
Maybe.
Cyber
getting
Monday.
Ready for
if
it,
you
I'm
have
sure.
not taken advantage of Cyber Monday, here on the November the 29th, you've missed it by a day. Don't worry.
And if you haven't bought the stock, buy the stock. Anything under 800, buy it.
There you go. Armand Kachigian, yeah, stop tip for the day.
That's right.
Armand, let me take you to 1929. Let me take you all the way down south. And I mean all the way. Where the only direction you can go is north.
There is no direction.
U.S. actually. Admiral Richard E. Byrd leads the first expedition to fly over.
The E was for, I don't know.
The South Pole.
Evelyn Byrd, that was the E's for, just in case somebody's wondering. Yeah, he flew over the South Pole. Now, we all know that the first person to reach or the first party to reach the South Pole was Roald Amundsen in, I believe, 1909. Going to look that one up. But he beat Scott. They had that race, you know, the Britisher Scott anyway. But he was the first to fly over it. Then he flew over the North Pole, or actually he flew over the North Pole first, I believe. They kind of wonder if he really did that. They're not really sure he'd
what,
apparently
did,
the
wait,
speed of his airplane, you know, when he logged in and logged back, logged out and logged in of the for the trip.
A little
his
too
plane
quick.
Didn't go that fast, you know. So
gotcha.
there's some debate over whether he actually flew over the
you're
North
Pole.
You're
saying it's how they know they got you at the toll booth.
Yeah, kind of like that. Yeah, yeah. The early 20th century version of GPS. but anyway, he did apparently do that, and he received the Medal of Honor. He was, you know, he's feted all over the world, and he was a very interesting guy. This guy, he was Operation Deep Freeze, that was him, where in relation to what's going on today, we do have bases in McMurdo Sound and in the Bay of Whales. These are permanent American bases in Antarctica. He began those. That was his baby in the 50s, I believe. In
wow.
fact, I think it had to be during 56 or 57 because that was the World Geophysical Year. You heard of that?
Yes.
Okay, that was Byrd. That was his contribution to that. Interesting thing about his son. I think it was 1968 or 69 after he died. They wanted to make a museum to him.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert Byrd III, he was Robert E. Byrd Jr., his son, apparently was taking the train from, I guess, Baltimore up to Massachusetts or somewhere, wherever they're going to do this museum. Disappeared. Found the kid 3 weeks later dead in some abandoned building in New York, dehydrated, malnourished, died of starvation, literally. Couldn't figure out what the hell happened to him. Never did figure out what happened to
him. It's a
hell
of a mystery.
Not he was like he's poor or indigent either. He actually had a pretty good legacy from his father.
Exactly.
So they don't know what got into this guy, but that's a mystery of the Byrds.
On a previous show, you had mentioned a military operation, Armand, called Operation High Jump.
Long jump.
Long
jump. Right?
Well, okay, long jump. I'm sorry.
The assassination attempt?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, there,
long jump.
Mm-hmm. There also is an Operation High Jump.
Yeah.
That Byrd is involved with because James Forrestal had
Defense
given,
Secretary.
Yeah, and who the aircraft carrier.
Well, Secretary of War, I believe,
was
at that
subsequently
time.
Named after, USS Forrestal. He put Byrd in charge of, you know, Arctic developmental projects, which is basically, okay. You know, as I look at it, at that era, is that what's the militaristic ramification?
When would that have been? Forrestal, I guess, was late 40s.
It would have been
Cold
in the
War,
late,
I guess.
It's
right
in
now?
The late 40s.
Okay.
The operation, you know, was launched in 1946. So it's an immediate early Cold War thing, but it's not like it's missile defense.
No, there were no missiles.
Because there's no missiles coming over the top from the Soviet Union or other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like you're planting missile bases in the Arctic because you aren't to the point of having nuclear submarines at this point.
We didn't have that capability. So I'm not sure what they were up to. But there was such distrust of the Russians at that point, except by Roosevelt, of course, that who knows what they were, you know, they were, I guess, approaching every avenue that they could use to invade Canada or Baffin Island or whatever.
Future recon for, you know, the land masses that are actually there.
You can't trust those commies. Who knows what they were up to?
He was also this is
amphibious landings in Hudson Bay.
In terms of operations that Byrd was involved with, the names are great. The Operation High Jump.
That's a good one.
Also in Operation Deep Freeze.
Oh, okay. Deep freeze.
Not just deep freeze, but deep freeze one.
I think that's the bases, wasn't it? Isn't that what those were? Wasn't that what we were talking about? McMurdo base and everything?
The permanent U.S. military presence to begin establishing that in the Antarctic.
Right, right.
Here's a question. Why in the hell does anyone ever want to explore the poles? Do you want to go and freeze your ass off for months at a time?
Why do they climb Everest?
Okay, they
climb. Because it's there.
Because it's there. Okay, all right.
Yes. Why are people going to Mars? That to me is even more ludicrous on a one-way trip.
Because we're getting off this rock.
Because of global warming? Oh, by the way, I'd like to tell our audience, check out Surreal Talk this week. I was a guest, the guest expert on global warming. So
yeah, I do.
We've debunked that hoax.
I do.
I hope we've put that to bed.
What you do is you should go to surrealtalkpodcast.com, okay? Very, very good show hosted by Everett and Eric Hicks here on lineupmedia.fm. The episode number that you're going to look for at surrealtalkpodcast.com is episode 19, where the topic, as they call it, the hot topic, is global warming. And
don't get in a sweat over global warming.
The global warming denier, Armand Kachigian.
See, now I object to that term. I'm not a denier.
What are you then?
I'm a scientist that has
evidence,
skepticism
that
about
has research
at the theater. Absolutely.
Okay.
And I'll be glad to cite any of it. We'll go into some detail on that too.
This
when Al Gore's birthday comes,
this show is
we'll really excoriate
when
that
Al Gore's
guy.
Birthday comes, I'll make sure to
and that goes for his dad too.
I'll make sure to leave him off the list.
You can just stay home that day. I'll just take the whole show. Right. There'll be one subject, and it'll be global warming.
Let's move to our next big topic, and this one is a big one. In fact, as one of the themes of the show. The things, the events that occur on dates that affect us the most to this day.
Okay, this better be big.
This is huge. In 1947, the United Nations General Assembly goes ahead and they approve the plan for the partitioning of Palestine.
Yeah, that was, a little history on this. Okay, let's start in 1937. Well, actually, let's start in World War I. You know the story of how all this began? I always thought this was interesting. I have gone over it on Ocho Man's show, but the people on that show just want to hear about sex, so I don't think they really care about it that much. But basically, during World War I, when the British obviously were fighting the Germans, a lot of the British shells that they were using were duds. Over 30-40% of them were duds.
Because?
Right, because
they just didn't work.
Yeah, they just did not work, because of the blasting cap. Well, Chaim Weizmann, who we all know was the first president of Israel after Einstein turned it down, Chaim Weizmann was a chemist, okay? And he developed a cordite detonation pin, cordite, using that. And immediately the rate of duds went down to like 3-4% or less. It was not much. Chaim Weizmann was an ardent Zionist. He was Jewish, of course, and he wanted a homeland for...
I don't think a lot of younger Americans understand what Zionism means.
Yeah, a movement to...
Jewish nationalism.
Yeah, Jewish nationalism to have a place for their people, which they didn't have back then because of the diaspora. And we'll go over that, I'm sure, sometime. But anyway, Chaim Weizmann was good friends with Arthur Balfour, who was the prime minister, but that was later. I think at that time he might have been in charge of the War Department or Home Secretary, maybe. Maybe he was home. Anyway, very important man. Balfour was very impressed with this and wanted to show his gratitude to Weizmann for this, you know, these cordite, which really helped the cordite blasting caps. And he said, "What can I do for you?" And he was going to pay him. And he goes, "No, I want a homeland for my people." And I believe what was first proffered was Madagascar, of all places. And I think Uganda was in there, too. Mm. Like, would you take Uganda? No, we don't want Uganda, and we don't want Madagascar. Apparently, he wanted Palestine, mm-hmm. which was for obvious reasons in history. And Arthur Balfour, the Balfour Declaration, gave Palestine to the British. Now, after the war is over, you've got Transjordan, which the British controlled. 80% of that was split up. Anyway, so fast forward to 1937, the Peel Commission basically arranged for the Arabs and the Jews. They limited the Jewish immigration to 5,000 per year. They gave the Jews quite a bit of land. The Arabs didn't take it. They totally disregarded that and rescinded that that treat, whatever you want to call it. Then they had the White Paper in 1939. We can go over all these in more detail.
Well, and let me go with the White Paper in 1939 for a second, because the White Paper in 1939 established a limit on immigration.
Correct.
Okay.
75,000, I believe.
But following World War II, Truman asked the British, you know, let's go ahead and would you allow 100,000 immigrants from Europe into Palestine?
Right. Well, obviously 1939 was before the war, and you know, obviously we know that what happened to the Jews during the war.
Absolutely.
So a hell of a lot of them were refugees, and they needed a place. 75,000 wasn't going to cut it. Obviously, the Arabs were not enamored with having all these people. And here's the thing, though. They gave the Israelis mostly desert land. You know, none of this land was mostly, like, 60% of what they got was the Negev Desert. And this is just nothing. I mean, it's like Death Valley over there. So what they got was basically, it's not like they gave away all these areas that were so useful and arable and had all this irrigation. They did it all themselves. Now, what also made it, now, if you look at this partition that we're talking about, 1947, it looks, they called it a checkerboard partition, which is kind of odd. If you look at the map, there's little spots that you have the Arabs have control, and then the Jews
now,
have control.
I'm looking
control.
At it now.
Right.
Now.
It doesn't seem like there's any rhyme or reason
and
to it.
And then you have a Berlin-type situation in Jerusalem.
Jerusalem is a big problem.
Yeah.
And where the Jews were, there were big cities, more or less. So a lot of the Palestinians were going there because that's where there were jobs and things for them to do, and they went there. They just migrated there. Anyway, it was a big mess, and obviously didn't work out. The Arabs here again, they refused to abide by this treaty, and they pulled out. And now all of a sudden you've got about 750,000 Palestinian refugees that nobody wanted, by the way. Syria didn't take them, Jordan didn't take them, Saudi Arabia didn't take them. And then 1948 we had when Israel declared itself a nation. What, 6 hours later, they all declared war, and we had our first Arab-Israeli war, and of course, we've had unrest ever since.
I mean, and this, the global ramifications of the partition.
Well, this could be where World War III starts.
And, I mean, right, we could, you know.
We're still, you know, ostensibly, that's why, you know, the Arab oil embargo, we had the Six-Day War. I mean, these will come up. Of course, it's with unbelievable, like, menstrual regularity, these wars we're having over there, but if it's going to all blow up, that's where they think it's going to be, of course, in the Middle East.
One strip of land.
Yeah.
That has been so hotly contested for millennia.
Started with the Balfour Declaration.
Now,
look that up. That's interesting reading.
But, yeah, the Balfour Declaration, I will look that up in more in more detail. But the White Paper of 39, the Truman,
Peel Commission, all that.
And asking for, and here we, again, we are caught today with a refugee situation coming out of the same geographic area.
Yeah. And basically, in 1939, London, they had the London Conference, and they came out with the White Paper, and they basically said that there's no solving this problem. It's totally impracticable. So they kind of just gave up. And when the British give up,
yeah, that's,
it's all over.
That's pretty telling. All right, let's have some birthdays before we get back into our major
topics. Yeah, it's hard to beat that one for significance.
Today, the birthdays on this date, I'm going to run through a couple real quick.
There's I don't know the first one.
Well, the first one I did for this reason. In 1818, George Brown was born. Why do I bring up George Brown?
Never heard of him.
My best friend's name is George Matthew Brown. There you have it. In 1832, Louisa May Alcott's born. 1898, C.S. Lewis.
We discussed him the other day.
Did.
He died on the same day as Kennedy.
Died on the same day as President Kennedy was assassinated. I mean, in 1963.
Right.
Not just on the same calendar day.
Day
of. In 1922, the Cuban ball player, and a great one and a great coach, Minnie Minoso, was born.
To get hit by pitches. He led the league 10 years in a row.
He was good at it.
Yeah.
In 1927, this American sports broadcaster, he also hosts game shows, and he is one of the last.
He's an icon in L.A., let me tell you.
Last living links to the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Yeah.
Vin Scully, who just retired, was born. In 1928, a guy that I'm sure Armand voted many times against, the lieutenant governor of Illinois, the senator from Illinois, Paul Simon, was born. And then in 1932, a French soldier and politician who would go on to become the 22nd president of France was born, one Jacques Chirac.
Yeah. Let's go into detail on Black Jacques Chirac. Actually, his name was the bulldozer. That's what they called him. That kind of gives you an idea of his personality. He was a crook. And here's some interesting. What I want to bring up, the interesting parallels of this, our recent election, and the 2002 election in France. Now, get this. Here was the people that supported Chirac basically said that he was running against Jean-Marie Le Pen. That name should mean something to you.
Le Pen?
Yeah, because Marie Le Pen, the daughter of this guy, is running, and she's going to probably win next year in France. And believe me, there's going to be a Frexit, French exit from the euro.
And
so
she's going to
gird your loins for that.
She's going to unseat President Hollande?
Absolutely. Yep, she's going to win. But anyway, her dad's running. So basically they're saying, vote for the crook and not the fascist. That was the rallying cry in 2002. So there may be some parallels there. He was the mayor of Paris. He took some money for public works, etc. He had some rather shady dealings. And he didn't really have a really great economy when he was the president of France. So he didn't do a really great job. But he's still around, I believe. I don't think he's dead.
No, he's not dead. He's alive.
So he's hanging in there. His health is very bad, though. He's very frail now.
Okay.
And he's kind of losing his marbles.
1933, John Mayall.
I don't know this guy.
You don't know John Mayall and the Blues Breakers?
No, I don't.
Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page.
Oh.
They all belonged to his band.
When was this?
1960s.
Okay, obviously before Cream and...
Yes.
What was it? The
John Mayall.
Blues Breakers?
And the Blues Breakers.
Okay, I'll look that up. Because I like Jimmy Page, my favorite guitarist.
You would love it. They all have except for the Stones and the Beatles, a lot of rock and roll out of
who's
England.
Your favorite? Who's the greatest guitarist? Lead guitarist.
Lead?
Yeah.
Clapton?
Okay, good choice. Jimmy Page, but that's close.
It's six on one hand, half a dozen on the other.
Yeah, Jeff Beck is in there, too.
Absolutely. Well, again, you're talking about...
Was he involved?
You just look up who ball played with John Mayall.
Okay.
And it is a who's who of guitar playing.
Right,
shame on you for not knowing that name. Shame, Armand. In 1938, Gene Okerlund was born.
Name.
The great American ring announcer. And also, the very same date. How about this for coincidence?
Yeah.
Jerry Lawler, the king.
And we talked
the
about
king
that.
Is
now,
born.
You're saying that this Andy Kaufman debacle was all made up.
First of all, it's not a debacle.
It was a debacle.
No, it was great entertainment.
I thought it was real. I really did.
No, it wasn't.
And since I'm a wrestler, I was glad. Because Andy Kaufman was wrestling these women and just making a mockery, although... That's
brilliant.
Not technically my sport. You know me. My passions are science, women, and wrestling.
In that
and
order?
It's women first. But he was making a mockery. But pro wrestling is a mockery, let's face
it's a
it.
Show.
I'm talking about amateur wrestling.
It's a show.
Right? I'm talking about college wrestling.
No, college wrestling is not
right.
a mockery.
But it seemed like
Greco-Roman...
he was making it even more boorish than it was.
No. Greco-Roman wrestling
Folk
and Olympic
wrestling
are not a mockery.
Right.
They're very,
collegiate
very
wrestling.
Good sports.
Right.
Collegiate level, high school level.
So anyway, but I thought, well, good. Break the guy's neck. The hell with him.
Yeah. No, it was all set up.
Yeah, it was.
And
you
said
Lawler, a book about that?
Lawler and Kaufman played it to perfection.
Great. Yeah, I bought it.
Culminating with the stunt on the David Letterman show.
Right.
The
remember
late
that.
Show. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So those two, born on the same date. Also born on the exact same date in 1949, one of my favorites ever. And I mean, if you've never seen the Larry Sanders show.
Yeah, it's funny.
Gary Shandling is born on this date.
I like his stand-up routine, too. He's funny.
Yes,
I like Gary
Shandling. Fantastic. Here's a director you'll like. In 1954, Joel Cohn is born. And he and his brother
Academy
Ethan,
Award winner.
Fantastic films.
No Country for Old Men.
Barton Fink. Miller's Crossing.
Yeah, you quote that movie a lot. I was interested. Every time I bring up wrestling movies,
go see a Wallace Beery film.
Yeah, yeah. You talk. I mean, the only. Well, I like the movie. I think it gets a little screwy.
It's weird.
But the producer where he tells him to kiss his shoe.
Yeah.
That's in Hollywood. That's just not done. You know, a writer does not get his shoe kissed. Believe me.
1955, Howie Mandel was born, and in 1960, an underrated actress. You know her as Vicky from Raging Bull.
Right,
Vicky LaMotta, and we're talking about Kathy Moriarty.
Yeah, she's still around. Is she still working? I haven't seen her lately.
A little bit. 1961, an actor called Tom Sizemore, I like to call him America's Sergeant, was born. 1962, Andrew McCarthy, one of the original Brat Packers from the 1980s. One of my favorites in 1964, Don Cheadle, who was just sensational. Hotel Rwanda is probably his
impactful
work.
Great performance, yeah.
But his roles in the Ocean's 11, 12, and 13 movies.
Was he in Crash, too? Or one of the...
I have to look that up. 1969, Mariano Rivera, the Panamanian reliever for the New York Yankees.
I think he still is. Isn't he the save leader now?
He's
got the record.
He's the all-time best.
Okay.
He's the all-time
best.
Yeah,
I know his ERA is unbelievable.
1973, one of my favorite athletes ever was born. The Welsh footballer and manager, Ryan Giggs.
You're being a feat again.
Who played for Manchester United,
okay.
Who made his debut as, I believe, a 16-year-old.
Hmm.
And would go on to become United legend through and through.
Play for the British national team?
No, he was Welsh.
Oh,
so because
Welsh,
he was, and first of all, let me correct you, sir. The British do not have a national football team.
The English have
a national football team because they have four home countries. Each has their own team that plays in FIFA.
Are they ever going to win another World Cup? It's been 50 years.
No, they're not.
Okay.
No, they're not. And that's part of the reason is because... Well, if they could play...
I guess they're diluting their talent.
They're diluting it because Scotland has a team, Northern Ireland has a team, Wales has a team, and England has a team. So they've lost the services of players that could have been on a United Kingdom team, like Dennis Law, George Best.
Didn't seem to hurt West Germany. You know, they won.
No, they still won. Well,
yeah,
they
74.
They had lots of people.
78, they were second.
And the East Germans, they didn't like soccer so much. They like weightlifting. Some other birth dates on this date, 1803, Christian Doppler.
Yes, that's the one I added. Yes,
yeah.
And we've gone over this, and basically the Doppler effect, the wavelength of a wave depends on the velocity of the source and the observer. And the significance of this is that... You know, we've all stood there and listened to a train coming at us, and as it's going coming towards us and going away, obviously the wavelength of the sound changes, and the sound changes. It sounds different. Well, this is the basis, and this was the basis of Einstein and his theory of the speed of light.
Is this day in science or this day in history?
Yes, it's science.
Oh, okay.
Because basically what Einstein said was light does not do that. Light is the same for every observer. So something's wrong here. So mm-hmm. What is it? And he was the one revolutionary thought, time actually changes, not the velocity. And that is one hell of a momentous
moment.
Idea.
Yeah, it is.
Unbelievable.
And in 1797, a opera composer is born that you are quite partial to.
I like him, yeah. He's written 70 operas. I don't know. I haven't sat
70?
Through 70, yeah.
70?
Very prolific, yes.
And what's the name?
Gaetano Donizetti. Now, my favorite...
He sounds like a character from Inglourious Basterds is what he sounds like.
Well, yeah, he's a guy with a bat.
Oh.
If you're gonna listen to one of his operas, I would suggest take it a little easy, kind of ease yourself into it. Elixir of Love is one of my favorites.
Elixir of Love sounds like an album title.
After Rossini and Bellini both died, he was the only true genius of Italian opera back in the 1830s. And we have a dead opera composer, so that's why I added this one.
Yeah, we do. We'll have a dead opera composer later for
and
you.
And then I have a couple added. Joe Weider, who's the father.
Bodybuilder.
Yeah,
so
IFBB.
Okay, let me ask you about Joe
If we didn't
Joe
have Joe Weider.
Weider,
we wouldn't have Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Well, would we have had Johnny Weissmuller in the Tarzan look of the...
Yeah. He was before. Joe Weider was after that.
He was after that.
Yeah.
Okay.
But he started the
so
IFBB,
did he take it? Did
Mr.
he take
Olympia.
It one level up from Johnny
yeah.
Weissmuller?
Well, Johnny Weissmuller's a swimmer, you know, and he...
Yes, but he was still a ripped dude.
Yeah, he was in good shape, obviously, but bodybuilding per se really didn't start until the 60s and 70s, your first, you know, Mr. Universe, Mr.
So Weider, born in 1919.
And the first Mr. Olympia was Larry Scott, by the way.
Who else you got?
I got a big one. One of my favorites, 1895.
Yes.
All you Hollywood musical people, Busby Berkeley.
What a name.
Yeah, and that's his real name.
That's awesome.
He was the guy that the choreographer. You know, before Busby Berkeley, basically the director, the guy that's a choreographer basically was a choreographer. He told the dancers, you know, they did the steps, etc. And then the director and the editor actually did the filming. Busby Berkeley didn't do that. He took over. He was, you know, he told the director and the editor go to hell. Basically, he did it with one camera, so he couldn't be edited. And he actually was in the
Army. Was he
doing
it in one take?
Not always, but a lot of times he did. It was unbelievable. And he's the one that really, even though he wasn't the first.
Was he up in the big swing chair?
He did that, but the one you're probably familiar with is where the overhead shot of the girls doing the stars and all that stuff. Even though he wasn't the first to do that, he was the guy that really codified it and really made it famous. And he did Footlight Parade, which is a great movie, Gold Diggers of 1933, the biggie, The one with Ruby Keeler, 42nd Street.
Okay.
These are big productions, and they were all
big production numbers.
Probably saved Warner Brothers. Unfortunately, Busby got drunk one night and killed a couple people in his car. He got away with that. He wounded like five. And he kind of had a tumultuous relationship with Carol Landis, and she killed herself. And he might have had something to do with that, too.
But, a little stigma there.
But, yeah, it was interesting, though. He was in the Army, and he was a field officer with the artillery, and he noticed the drilling. And that's where he got his ideas. If you look, a lot of, these beautiful women, but they have that.
A little bit of a militaristic.
Yeah, it sure looks like that.
Left,
he's got
right,
that influence.
Left, right.
There you go.
How about
that? So check
that
out Busby Berkeley movies.
One more birthday for you, 1876.
Oh, I think you'll like this one, yeah.
Because I'm what?
Because you're a man. Because you're a man who appreciates the equal rights for women.
Yes, I do.
You're quite a crusader for this.
Yes, I do.
So crusade.
Nellie Taylor Ross is born on this date in 1876.
Yeah. First governor of a state, even though she took over after her husband died of, I think, a botched appendectomy.
That'll happen in 1876.
More botched medicine being momentous.
And what state did she take over?
Wyoming?
Sounds good.
I think it's Wyoming. I think she's still the only governor of Wyoming. I didn't write it down, but I'm pretty sure it's Wyoming.
What do you mean she's still the only governor of Wyoming?
Female governor.
Okay.
Female governor of
Wyoming.
She's still alive, yeah.
And she took over on the first centennial, 1876. Same year the National League is formed, same year Anheuser-Busch is formed.
Yeah, she was born in 1876.
A lot of stuff happened in 1876. Okay,
plus Colorado became a state.
Back to our big topics of the day here on November 29th. The next one I love. I love this topic. It is Project Mercury.
The
Mercury Atlas V mission specifically. This mission is launched into space. The spacecraft orbits the Earth twice, splashes down off the coast of Puerto Rico.
Yeah, with a
chimp
in it.
Why is this significant? Because there's a chimp in it.
Yeah.
The Mercury 7 astronauts had to take a backseat to Enos the chimp.
Yeah. Well, there's a little history here.
I cannot imagine.
First, we have to take a backseat to Ham the chimp, who went first, where no chimp has gone before. And that was kind of a warm-up for first they sent Ham up, and then just to see. And actually, now Ham was not just a passenger. This was interesting. They actually had some electric lights, and they kind of wondered if—
No, I know. He had to
do some things. Yeah. So Ham was a pretty bright chimp. And so he had to press some buttons just to make sure that people and primates could function out in space. So after he did a good job earlier in the year, 61, I think we said it was, then they sent up the first, Alan Shepard, first man to go suborbital, and then Gus Grissom went up. So then they didn't know if orbiting was a little different. So then they sent Enos up to make sure they could orbit. Now, he was supposed to go around three times, I believe, and then things were getting a little hot in his spacesuit, and they brought him down after two orbits. And he landed, and then they sent up the first American to orbit the Earth. That was John Glenn, who's still with us and still going into space sometimes. He just can't get enough. But there you go.
I love there's
he's a real hero.
There's a site out here with a story on this, okay? And just the way this sentence is written.
Okay.
The chimps of space, Ham, the first primate in space, and Enos, the second primate after Yuri Gagarin, to orbit the Earth.
Well, that's true. Gagarin's a primate. A Russian primate. They're different on the evolutionary tree, by the way. I think we split from the Russian primates back in the Pleistocene.
We have a list of primates.
Yeah. There's Homo habilis, Russian primates, Homo erectus, and then modern man. I think that's the way it goes.
And then Enos.
And Enos is in there somewhere.
Can you
imagine? Don't forget the bonobos. We were talking about bonobos today on
Ocho Man Show. How do you think they broke it to John Glenn? Alan Shepard.
Yeah, just to make sure there's a chimp.
Cooper and the rest of the Grissom.
Yeah.
Okay. These are Carpenter. These are monumental men we're talking about.
Yeah, the Mercury 7.
These are the Mercury 7. How do you think they broke it to
them? That's kind of what they made a joke about. You know, that we're not doing anything the chimps didn't do. You know, so they kind of had it. It was an injury. Here's a trivia question. One of my favorites. Who was the only astronaut to partake in Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo missions?
Grissom.
No? Wally Schirra.
But wasn't Grissom was in the Apollo capsule when he was killed?
I don't think he made the Gemini. I don't think he did Gemini.
He didn't make the Gemini.
No, he did not do a Gemini mission.
Wally Schirra.
Yeah, he was killed with Leonard White. Who was the other one? Grissom, White, Chaffee.
Chaffee.
Chaffee. Yeah, they died on the
pad.
Now I think
in the fire.
Right.
Now, they
didn't go up. Right. The fire was while it was on the gantry. Right.
Well, yeah, but it was a test.
Right.
They were not scheduled.
I think
for
there's only like
launch.
Two or three Russians that have died actually in space. Did you know that? I got to look up their names, but there's like one
ass
accident.
Most of them died on the pad.
Yeah, what happens? Or splashed down or
whatever.
For cosmonauts.
Yeah.
But they died in space.
Yeah. Now, one of the things they did to old Enos here was, you know, he would have to hit a display.
Mm-hmm.
But if he hit the wrong display, he would get zapped in his foot.
Well, sure.
So you're already
What's wrong with that?
Well, no, what the hell? You're already in space.
I do the same thing with my patients.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, if they don't do what I tell them. Like, you know, about 50 watts usually
just
does it.
Cruel.
They don't wear their cast or
this is just
don't obey orders. Don't take their pills.
I always. You ever watch The Right Stuff?
In
The Right Stuff.
I've read it too. It's a good. Get that on Audible.com.
That's Thomas Wolfe, right?
Yeah, Tom okay. Wolfe.
Tom
yeah.
Wolfe, not Thomas.
There's
Tom
a
Wolfe.
Yeah, Tom Wolfe. Great book.
When the scene where they get that chimp out.
Yeah, I got to watch that again. It's been a long time. It's a great movie.
And the Ed Harris character.
There's your favorite.
Playing
yeah.
John Glenn.
Ed Harris. I know you're a big fan of his. We've gone over him.
All right, let's move a decade later. So we go from Project Mercury.
Yeah, something even more momentous. You're going to have to take this one.
Okay, now I will, and you should ask a lot of questions. Because this had a cultural shift that was seismic.
Yeah, we're still feeling it, I'm afraid.
In 1972, Atari announces the release of Pong.
Yeah.
The first commercially successful video game. And I stress, not the first video game, the first...
I don't think it was even the first tennis game, right, per se.
Commercially successful game. Which then Atari, which soon after becomes the fastest growing company in the United States and into the world. A game called E.T. the Extraterrestrial happened to them, and then subsequent gaming systems did just not sell well.
Oh, okay.
But they
flopped
around 1983. They messed it up with. And in fact, there's a very good documentaries about Atari out there.
Any books we can read on audio or Amazon? It sounds interesting.
More in the world. I would recommend documentaries.
Okay.
Because Warner got a hold of Atari.
Well, you can get those on Amazon too, right?
Yeah, you can. They ended up. They had so many unsold cartridges of E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
Wow.
And the game was so bad. And I got this game, Armand.
Wow, must be a collector's item, huh? You still have it.
I do. It's in my mom's basement, and it was so bad. It was unplayable. They couldn't sell them. They wound up burying them in a landfill in New Mexico. And there's a documentary about. A project to unearth the landfill to see if this was true, because it was an urban legend.
Oh,
that this had happened, and it indeed did.
Okay,
they drilled down into the landfill and
found all these cartridges.
They started bringing up boxes of ET.
Doesn't seem so hard to believe to me. What are they going to do with them?
But the advent, because I can remember the courage it took me to muster as about a 10-year-old, 1981, and it had been out. But it was expensive.
What's that?
The Atari console.
Okay.
So to play a video game on your TV set at home, the ramification was huge. Because kids, when you say kids don't play outside anymore, well, here's the first reason why.
Yeah, I know. That's
Atari.
What I'm saying.
Atari. And every home video system that henceforth came after.
Well, now that you've brought that up.
It definitely changed my life because my parents would be like, that's it.
Right.
Enough. Get the hell out of this house. You're not sitting in front of this TV blowing up dots anymore.
And now, I mean, at this point, I dated a gal and, she told me her son, she had to remind him to eat. I mean, this is almost some sort of hypnosis.
No, it is. There was a game called Defender. It was an arcade game.
I remember that
game.
I love that game.
It was a great arcade game as a coin-op game.
Right.
Armand. And then it came out as the Atari version.
Okay.
Graphics are not near as good. But my friend Mike and I played Defender one day while our parents were gone so long that I couldn't stand up. My legs had completely fallen asleep. We had racked up something like 30 million points. It was one of those things where you're supposed to take the picture and send it into the magazine showing that you've created the new high score. And you just, people just got that good at these games.
I was an Asteroids guy.
Asteroids was a tough game, though. Asteroids was not necessarily
easy. Yeah, but when you learned how to hunt the little spaceships.
Well, then you got it.
Then you could play for hours.
Then you could play for hours. Once you learned
that was a computer glitch.
Once you learned the recoil.
Right.
But this is the era. So you combine the Atari, and then, which becomes pretty ubiquitous in American life around 78, 79 in the early 80s, combine that with the advent of basic cable TV.
Ooh.
And kids aren't leaving the house.
The death knell of sandlot baseball, corkball games.
Exactly. Exactly.
I don't think that's a good thing.
No, it's not, because I can distinctly remember being a little kid, being outside all the time, then hitting 10 or 11 and only being outside about half the time.
Well, then now they're talking about, I guess there are some good things. They say we're breeding better pilots because of this, and some of the hand and eye coordination helps. And visual perception is improved. But I'm telling you, we got obese. Yeah, okay, I'll grant you that. But we have obese,
some kids.
My kid
plays relentlessly.
Right.
He's certainly not obese. He's a skinny little runt, but not really little anymore.
But wouldn't you rather have him, you know, going on Amazon.com, reading on some of the? I always read history. I don't know. I just that's what I did. And my mom used to tell me go outside too. But I was either playing chess and practicing my openings, or reading. And she said, you got to get some sun. Get the hell out of here.
You're practicing your gambits, huh?
Yes. Well, I played a pretty mean king's gambit. Okay. You know me, hell for leather.
You and Bobby Fischer.
Yeah, well, I think I could take him now that he's a corpse. We've got to have a special show on him, too.
The effect Atari had, though, was immense. It permeated everything.
Still does.
American pop culture, American business. The effect it had was wide,
undeniable,
wide-reaching,
incontrovertible,
and the social impact it had.
I
can tell you the social impact.
That's what I'm saying.
If you had the player, you had friends. If you did not have the player, you did not.
Well, I would say it's not good for introversion and all that sort of thing. But now these kids play. I can be in my living room, right? And I'm playing you, and you're in Los Angeles or something, right? You can play anybody anywhere.
My son hardly
talk to them.
He hardly ever plays alone.
Yeah.
And in fact, he spends a lot of time, speaking with friends in England and California.
I didn't know that. And I'm dating this girl, and we're eating dinner, and she has to remind the kid. He's in their living room playing, talking to someone. I said, you know, your kid's hearing night voices. I think he needs psychiatric help.
No.
I said, no, he's talking to his friend.
Live person.
There's no kid in there.
No. Live person on the other end. His friend's at his house. Right.
I don't know.
So on this date, November 29th,
the way
our homes are conducted took a big change.
First step in the Trail of Tears.
With the release of Pong. One more big topic to get to before we wrap up with our deaths.
My favorite.
But on this date in 1935, Armand, I will hand the floor to you.
Yes, we were talking about Werner Heisenberg the other day. This is kind of involved in that too. This is the day that my favorite thought experiment, Schrodinger's cat, 1935, and it's named after a physicist named Schrodinger. Now, here's basically what this man has to say, and this is where it gets really creepy with quantum mechanics. You take a box. You have a cat in the box, okay? There's also a pellet of poison in the box, or cyanide, okay?
Yeah.
If it drops into this emulsion, it goes off and kills the cat, right? Now, what sets off this pellet is you have a radioactive element in it. If this radioactive element decays, it undergoes some kind of decay. It sets off a lever, pulls the lever. The cyanide goes into the liquid, just like the gas chamber in San Quentin used to do, kills the cat. According to quantum physics, quantum mechanics, that cat is neither. If you don't look in the box, you can't see what's in the box. That cat is both alive and dead. That's quantum mechanics. That's how Schrodinger explained it. Now, it's also, what's even creepier is if you open the box and you look, you're going to change whether the cat was dead or alive. The cat could have been alive till you looked. So even the very act of looking at something changes that particle.
Which is to say that just observing something,
changes it.
And anything. Hence, a particle can change.
Which is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
Uncertainty
you cannot know a particle's position and its momentum at the same time. And this opens up a lot. Now, Einstein didn't believe all this stuff. He went to his grave not believing a lot of this stuff. But this is an interesting, it just goes to show you, and it used to be before quantum mechanics came along, I don't know if you remember this. I remember in high school, one of my buddies said, do you know if you knew everything to know in the universe, you could predict the future? And that is absolutely false. Because quantum mechanics tells us, even if you know everything, there is so much that is completely ununiform. And for instance,
electrons. Is this randomness or chaos theory?
Well, it's randomness that there's nothing predictable about. For instance, an electron. If you remember your high school chemistry,
it's orbiting the neutron.
Yeah, it doesn't
proton.
Do that. It's a cloud, basically. It's like it's not a circular orbit like the Earth around the sun. So there is inherent unpredictability, chaos, whatever you want to call it. And we can't predict anything, basically. You can't even tell, like I said, if this cat is alive or dead. Now, there are other ramifications, which we'll go into, I'm sure. Quantum entanglement, superimposability.
How many cats did Schrodinger kill?
We don't know. You don't know that's a thought experiment. But
well, did he look?
Well, if he did, he changed everything. So, of course, there's a multiple world theory that he may have killed a lot, but saved a lot too. So, who knows what he did?
Oh, bully for him!
Yeah. So, Schrodinger's cat. Look that up.
All right. Now, as we do on every show, we
in fact, there's a book. If you check.
I will.
Who killed Schrodinger's cat? I think it was by Gribben. Edward Gribben, I think his name was.
Let's see if it's on audible.com.
He's a good author, actually. If you want to, he's physics for the layman. I think it's called Who Killed Schrodinger's Cat?
Not turning it up.
Okay, we'll look it up then. Is Gribben on there? Physicist? Because he's got a couple of books that are probably worth checking out if you want to, probably on Audible too.
Yeah. So the.
Look him up.
The deaths, yeah. As we wrap up the show. There's some interesting ones today.
Another composer.
Yeah.
Giacomo Puccini, probably one. But besides Verdi, Wagner, and Mozart, probably the most performed.
Do you have a favorite Puccini opera?
La Boheme.
I think that's pretty much everyone's standard.
Yeah, I think that one's performed more than almost probably more than any, except maybe Carmen.
Okay, he was a
philanderer.
He loved his women. Composer.
Yeah, who he had fun.
Well, it does say
he might not have been a fascist.
It does say here he is the Italian composer and educator.
Yeah, I don't know where that comes from. He educated a lot of women. Being a euphemism for banging.
Mean a lot of things. Well, he died on this date, November.
Pretty good friends with Mussolini.
November the 29th in 1924. So he missed a lot of the coming
festivities. Well, Mussolini was still, he was making the trains run on time, so he was kind of the savior of Italy at that time.
On this date in 1974, James J. Braddock passes
Cinderella
away.
Cinderella man.
Yes.
Has the worst winning percentage of any heavyweight champion ever.
Yeah.
He had 35 losses.
He fought a lot.
Yeah. Well, and lost a lot.
I don't take anything.
We talked about the guy he beat, Max Baer, the other day. Yeah. Was not a bad guy.
No, they fought in some big arenas too.
Yeah, that was
a
big upset.
That's when you used to go to Yankee Stadium and hold the world heavyweight fight. On this date in 1975, the English race car driver and businessman, and a very good businessman, Graham Hill, passed away. His son Damon Hill would go on to become F1 superstar in his own right. But Graham Hill, a fantastic driver and world renowned. On this date in 1980, Dorothy Day, the American journalist and activist who co-founded the Catholic Workers Movement, passed away.
I like this next one.
You like the next one? I'm going to give you a thought on this next one.
All right. Miracle on 34th Street's coming up.
There you go.
Interesting.
And she starred in films such as, A West Side Story.
Rebel Without a Cause.
Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah, she wasn't real happy that they dubbed her. And you know who dubbed her? She just died, actually, by the way. Marnie Nixon, who dubbed just about everybody.
No kidding.
Yeah, Marnie Nixon just died a few months ago last year.
Okay, so on this date, Natalie Wood drowns.
Yeah.
In what is still contested to this day.
Right.
Do you have a take on Robert Wagner and Christopher Walken from that night?
What
do you think happened?
I think she caught Wagner and Walken in bed.
As opposed to Wagner
catching her and walking in bed.
So she decided to go for a swim.
She got a little ticked off, and I don't know what happened there. She was drunk. She apparently was deathly afraid of water, which, of course, they go sailing. Because I remember reading Robert Redford was talking about making Inside Daisy Clover with her, and they were good friends because they both went to Hollywood High. And they had a scene by the swimming pool, and he just, as a joke, tossed her in, and she was terrified of water, screaming her head off. Yeah, so I don't think we'll ever have on that boat.
Any chance we ever have a resolution to that mystery?
No, I don't think. I think that one's
you
been
put
Walken to bed.
Think Walken and Wagner take that one to their graves?
I think that, yeah.
Okay.
That's
in 1986, Cary Grant
never won an
away.
Academy Award.
Yeah. What was his real name?
Archie Leach.
Yeah, Archibald Leach.
Yeah.
1991, Ralph Bellamy passed away. And in 1999.
And we were talking about Rosalind Russell. There you go. We were talking about His Girl Friday.
Yes.
Ralph Bellamy, Cary Grant, and Rosalind Russell. You get three for one there. Watch that movie.
There you have it. 1999, Gene Rayburn, the American game show host.
Yeah, he was funny. I liked him.
Very funny. Boy, did he have a nice microphone.
Yeah, that big long one.
Oh, his mic. That's the best. That is the gold standard for me of microphones.
They still have the match game? Is there currently
a
match game?
There's a new iteration of it.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, here's somebody.
Favorite match game panelist?
Charles Nelson Reilly.
It has to be, doesn't
yeah,
it?
I like him. Yeah. He died under some mysterious, not mysterious, but you know, like his gay lover, they want to keep his, he had a lot of money. And
you ever see Alec Baldwin's impersonation of Charles Nelson?
No.
Oh, it is, okay. It is
I'll check
dynamite. Two more for you. Just two more. Okay. On this date in 2001, George Harrison.
Yeah, cancer, right?
Yeah, he became the second member of the Beatles to pass away.
I like his sing when, you know, when
you like,
we, when
did
we
you
were
like
fab.
My, you like that? Did
yeah,
you like My Sweet
song.
Lord?
Yeah. I like When We Was Fab is my favorite Harrison. But yeah, he had some really great stuff.
And one final death to note in 2004, this one's for you, the great, great acting family. John Drew Barrymore passed away.
I don't know him. I mean, is he John Barrymore's son? Because John Barrymore died in 1942.
Right.
The Great Profile. I don't know who this guy is. And I got a few myself.
Okay, let's hear him.
Prince Rupert of the Rhine, who made his bone. You know me in English history, and I'm a big Civil War fan. The English Civil War.
Just say the name again, please.
Prince Rupert of the Rhine.
There
fought for
it.
Charles I. Very interesting guy. There's probably some.
Quit
look
yelling.
Him up. Somebody, well, I get a little excited. Prince Rupert gets me going.
Okay.
This guy gets even more going. Eric Wolfgang Korngold. Died in 1957. First man to win the best score, 1938. He won the Academy Award. Before that, they were giving the best music award to the whole department. The music
okay,
department.
So he wins best score.
Yeah.
What was the film?
My favorite film of all time, Adventures of Robin Hood with Errol Flynn.
Errol Flynn. Yeah, that was a good
Eric
one.
Wolfgang
I have
Korngold.
That one on DVD, actually.
What a great movie.
Yeah.
And you know this guy, Jorn Utzon?
I've heard the name.
Yeah. Designed the Sydney Opera House.
Ooh,
didn't
nice
finish
piece,
it.
Nice
got
piece
pissed
of
off.
Architecture.
Didn't feel like he was getting paid his proper fee.
Yeah.
Had a lot of problem with the city council and just quit, and they finished without him. But boy, what a building that is.
A international landmark.
Yeah.
Yeah, truly. But, it's one I'd love to see in person and see a Puccini opera.
Interesting.
There. How about that, Armand?
Here's a little interesting aside. A little Philip. You know, I appeared on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Yes, you were a contestant on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
The lady who went before me won $1 million. I won $500,000. Her $500,000 question was, who designed the Sydney Opera House?
Oh.
She got it. Jorn Utzon.
Jorn Utzon.
Utzon. U-T-Z-O-N.
Utzon.
Utzon. Yeah.
Okay.
So there you go.
All right. Hey, don't forget to check our website out, This Day in History Podcast. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/ThisDayInHistoryPodcast. And, of course, subscribe. iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, any major podcast outlet. We bring you shows Monday through Friday, except on major holidays. But Monday through Friday, we have new material for you. For Armand Kachigian, I'm Tony Hubert. This has been This Day in History, part of lineupmedia.fm. And we'll talk to you tomorrow when November 30th rolls around.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.